You're listening to the best of Dave Fanning on 2FM.
At the end of October, I was joined by The Edge and Adam Clayton of U2 to discuss the 20th anniversary of the album All That You Can't Leave Behind and the inspiration behind the songs on the album. I started by asking them if musically the album All That You Can't Leave Behind was about basically just getting back to or acknowledging their past.
Maybe a little bit of us relaxing our slightly, I would say, almost fascist sense of needing to always look forward and never look back. It was for us a kind of golden rule. We just do not rest on laurels. We do not repeat ourselves. We always forge into the future and look forward. On this album, I think we allowed ourselves to revisit certain sounds and certain approaches. But that being said, it was the beginning of a sort of a new phase of the band in terms of trying to be super disciplined with songs. And on this record, I think that some of the great songs of that decade were on All That You Can't Leave Behind. Beautiful Day, obviously, Kite, Stuck in a Moment You Can't Get Out Of. They, you know, we did really dig deep to get to those tunes.
And are you happy at the way it sort of strings together as an album? I mean, a bunch of great songs, but they really... would you take a lot of time saying which one follows which one?
Yeah, we did a lot of that, but also what was going to make the album, what wasn't going to make the album. I think Wild Honey, Adam, can you remember? I think that was sort of in and out of the album for a while because it seemed so wide-eyed and so kind of positive. But then in the final analysis, putting it next to Peace on Earth, which is so dark and so some ways negative, most negative U2 song I think that we've ever released. So it's, they balanced each other out, I thought, quite well.
Wild Honey was sort of really off the record until the very last minute when we were doing the sequencing. So to answer your question, you know, we're playing around with it all the time, trying to get things to fit in. And we, you know, Stuck in a Moment was a very heavy theme in that it dealt with Michael Hutchence's sort of premature death, which, you know, there was a lot of feeling in us of regret and I think remorse about whether or not we could have done more for him at that time, or certainly to honour that relationship. Then, as Edge said, Peace on Earth is one of those very heavy songs, which, you know, nobody knew at the time, but we were in the middle of the peace process. And the Omar bombing happened, which I think disgusted the whole country. There's a lot in this record.
Okay, well, Peace on Earth, as you say, the Omar bombing from 1998, and then Peace on Earth was the song. But then it actually took on a whole new life post 9/11 as well, in terms of American radio. And it just was a very different thing this century. But just to get back to what you're saying there about Stuck in a Moment and Michael Hutchence, you know, this was kind of a very big sort of soulful ballad. I mean, what makes you say, let's get gospel in there, let's get a choir in there, let's get a piano in there, let's get horns, let's think about it maybe as lighters in a field when we're playing it to 80,000 people. Do you think along those lines?
Well, that song sort of grew organically. I started with the music in Tokyo on the Pop Mart tour, and I happened to have a piano in my hotel room. So I was playing around with some gospel chords and hit on some cool changes. Then back in Dublin, myself and Bono started working on the melodic ideas. And it was really, at first it was it felt like a very sort of commercial melodic tune, but of course now you put the lyric about Michael into that context and it gives it that intensity and that weight. And I think it's an example, I think, of why Bono is such a great writer. He does understand the need to create some kind of tension and almost dichotomy within a piece of music, that it doesn't sort of always follow the same trend. It's like you create tension between a lyric which is very heavy and a song that's very light, and suddenly you've got something that really has breadth and depth. So I think you know, a lot of our songs, we start working on them, Beautiful Day is another example, and you've got this sort of sense of what it is. There's an instinct that there's something great in there. But to get to the final the final thing is often about unlocking these contradictions. So with Beautiful Day, it was very much a rock and roll tune early on, and it wasn't until Brian and Danny threw in this very robotic intro that we unlocked the kind of way to present that, so it didn't just sound like a bunch of lads in a rehearsal room.
That was Beautiful Day by U2, and indeed the lead singer of that very band turned 60 in May. And we gave his birthday a nod by digging out the earliest interview I could find with him, well, one of them anyway, from the 1979-80 direction. Have a listen to a whippersnapper Bono here.
Now then, out of control stories for boys and boy, girl. There is a possibility, Bono, of U2, that U2 are still one of the youngest bands around in the circuit at the moment.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, if that's right, and you do write about, say, teenage things, say, in any way, can you be compared to a band like The Undertones or anything like that?
No. I hope not. I like The Undertones, I respect The Undertones, but we're not... They sort of see themselves as very much a throwaway type of band. Maybe it's pompous of us, but we don't. We feel that the music's something to be valued and something to hold on to, not throw away. But we have the same maybe attitude to the business. I realise the business for what it is. It's a big industry. There's a lot of people trying to stand on us. We hope our management, right, are aware of that, and our management are aware of that. But rather than pretending that it's not there, rather than going out in Poland accent and sandals on stage, we'd like to join that race and, in fact, beat the people that are involved. Make use of it rather than just go totally against it. We are teenagers, we are young. There is the big chance that we will be exploited, but we hope we're not stupid as much as we might be young. And that's the value to the music, in the sense that a lot of bands that we're listening now, we call them new wave bands, or many of them are about sort of 24, 25. How old are you, Dave? And they're writing
66.
And they're writing about things that they don't really know about. They maybe remember about. But we are at the age that it's happening, so to speak.
Well, I wasn't trying to imply for a second that the music that you two are making is like the music that the Undertones are making.
Yeah, right.
But the same token, if I was asked to pigeonhole you two, where should I put them?
I hope there is no exact bracket you can put us in. I hope the band is ambiguous, the musical stance is ambiguous. The name was chosen for that reason, that has no particular liaison with punk, be it, or old wave. The name, I don't know what the name is. The reason we joined up in the first place was not just to be part of any one movement. It's true that the whole new wave thing influenced us a lot, but it was basically disillusionment with the crap that was going on in the top 30. And we thought we'd have something to say. And that's what we're about, and we're trying to put what we have to say on record. That's our ambition.
Well, have you got enough together whereby if CBS Records was to say, yeah, we really like this single and it's doing very well, how about an album by the end of next month? What if something like that came along?
Yeah, we could do an album tomorrow. We've written 25 tracks. We play, I think, 14 of them at the moment. We've tracks written that we don't include in our set because of the balance we have worked out for the sled. We've tracks written for the second album, which might sound, again, very pompous. And we've a lot of material which we've grown out of, sort of simpler material as we grew up, you know, footballer learns new tricks, that type of thing.
Right, well, the point about it is that, like, for instance, later on this evening now, you'll be playing those 14 numbers, I presume, in the Bag It In and Bag It Street in Dublin,
mm-hmm.
where the Blades will support that. We'll have some music from the Blades later on as well. So, like, you'll be playing that one, and you have played in Cork many times as well. Have you played the other places around the country? In that I get a lot of letters, say, from places like Leitrim and Offaly and Monaghan, saying, yeah. Why the hell don't these bands play over here?
Yeah, well, it's true, because we play an original set, you know, we have certain difficulties in the towns, right? We're not a show band. We're not Brush Shields. I don't know what he is. We're U2, and it's true enough, there is a certain amount of difficulty in playing the towns. We played Carlow on Thursday night, and we had some fun. Well, we get what's Gavin from the Virgin Prunes would call a television reaction. They look and they're not sure, you know, they don't sort of, you know, they want maybe either to turn up the sound louder or change channel. We have a few converts. We often feel like a missionary down the country, you know. I often, in fact, say, because there's people Dana, we're expected to treat them like simple people, you know. A lot of the promoters, I'm going to say this over here, because this
are you sure about that, though?
This, no, this is true, right? Our promoters, and I'm not talking off the cuff, this has been said to us, that if we want to play the towns, and I'm telling this because it goes nationwide, and this is a point I feel very strongly about, is that if you want to play the towns, you've got to play numerous status quo cover versions. Numerous. They want to hear Cocaine by Eric Clapton over there. This is not true. There's people in those towns, right, who want to hear what you have to say. We found this out, right? And Cork, we've got quite. I like to say hello to the people in Cork because they're really smart.
What you're saying is, like, it's a myth to think that you have to do your cabaret bit, like whereby you play Whiskey in the Jar and River Deep, Mountain High, and a few more, and then go in to play your own ones as well. And the only way your own that your own songs will be accepted is to play some other cover versions as well.
That's right. I'm not saying it's a myth because it's true, but I hope that it'll change. It's stations like this that will change that. But we're actually told that this is the only way we can do it going down the country. And the people in the towns, with a certain amount, there's a population which are reacting against this, right? Because they don't want to have that tag. But there's another part of the population that are just sitting back and listening to it, and they do. You know, after one speech where I explained this, a guy stood up and said, "Right, fair enough, status quo." And there is this. Now I'm not knocking anybody on the musical tastes, right? I'm sure at one stage I listened to status quo.
he was but a mere boy back then. See what I did there? From one lead singer to another now, Rob Halford, lead singer of Judas Priest. In his autobiography, Confess, which was released earlier this year, Rob charts 5 decades of his life with one of the most successful heavy metal bands of all time. He also talks to me about his personal experience as a gay man in a genre which has very few, and one of the most difficult times for Judas Priest when a tragedy landed them in the centre of a court case. I asked him first whether being a gay man who wasn't out and being the frontman of a massive heavy metal band meant that he spent a long time living his life for other people.
Well, that's great. You nailed it there at the end of your question, because you do. Until you break out and you proclaim yourself and you find self-love and you realise that this is your life and that it's best lived on your terms and you can find the balance and harmony, then you can take that out into the world. But, yeah, you know, the music sustained me in those times. You know, as a gay man that was hidden firmly away in the leather closet, so to speak, it was tough. It was tough. I wasn't able to be myself and to express myself the way that I felt I needed to. And it was difficult. You know, it's difficult for any of us that are struggling with sexual identity, no matter where you are in life, because there's so much going on in your mind about the ifs and whys and wherefores. But it was tough. But yeah, the music definitely sustained me and got me through a lot of those difficult moments.
And overall, you have had a lot of loneliness throughout most of your life. But having said that, what you did when you came out was the best thing you could possibly have done. And you really wish you had done it before that.
Absolutely. And I think most people like myself would agree with what you've said, Dave. It's a fact. You stop living a double life. You're able to get away from all the kind of stories that you have to make up and the innuendo and then the kind of sniggering behind your back attacks. All that fades away. It bounces off you. You know, it makes you a stronger person.
And was it the typical rock thing when you were just doing it, as in the studio, in other words, making albums, and the road? The studio, the road.
Oh, yeah. I love it. Still doing it now, 50 years later, Dave. Yeah, still doing it now. Yeah. And again, it's what we are. It's what we're about in this beautiful band, Judas Priest. You know, we can't do it again without our fans. We always give a massive shout out to our beautiful fans that have given us the drive and the purpose. It's one thing to be a creative person, but you need your fans. You need people to look after you, because it's an exchange. It's a relationship. And in music, it's a very powerful one because of the emotions involved.
Okay, Confess is what we're talking about here. It's an amazing book, really. It's just, in fact, there's one review of the book I noticed, and it does hit the nail on the head when it says it's just about, you know, it's the most wide open and honest since Andre Agassi. And his was wide open and honest, I can tell you. We're talking to Rob Halford here, Judas Priest. So, Rob, let's just take a look. There are many random sexual encounters in truck stops across the US on it as well. And you write these all in, you're completely honest. Has anybody expressed any, like, they're offended or shocked or anything like that?
Well, you know, opinions are what they are, aren't they? And and because I've been cleaning sober now for over 35 years, my goal in life is to be as truthful and as honest and as open as I possibly can. All of these things in the book have made me who I am. Some of them I'm not proud of. Some of them were dangerous moments. Some of them were risky moments. Some of them were foolish moments. But that's what all of us in life have made choices that we would reflect on and say, I wish I could have done that differently, or I wish I could have said that differently. That's human nature. So I'm just being the guy that I am and put it all down there in black and white for you to have a look and think about.
Okay, but like, you know, when a fan asked you to sign something back in 1981 and said something that was obvious that you were gay, was that one of the, wow, like somebody knows kind of thing? I mean, like, you're playing to 10,000 head-banging metal maniacs every night or whatever, and then you struggle backstage with, you know, basically, as I said earlier, denying your true self, if you like, and you're off stage yearning for love, it's very difficult and it's not happening. When you decided to do what you do, did it help you in actually your work, and did you struggle before that?
Well, this is a great song. This song called Raw Deal from the Sin After Sin album that we talked about at the start of our chat day. You know, that's become quite a catalyst in many ways. I've always had to kind of bring it into the question that that was never kind of part of an agenda on my part, as like, oh, I'm going to write a song about a gay place in New York called Fire Island, and that'll send the message out that I'm a gay guy. This was just a bunch of words that I put together for a song that motivated me and created that emotion. The remarkable thing about it was, for decades, nobody really picked up on the story or the message. And it was a shock to, it was not so much a shock, I was pleasantly surprised when at a record store this one chap said, is that about a gay place in New York? And I thought, oh, well, at least somebody's got the idea of the story. But it's become a very important moment in terms of reflection for what the message in that song contains.
And do you have friends who are deeply closeted and that works for them? Fine.
Absolutely. I've said all along, if you choose to stay where you are and you're living your life and it's and you're healthy, mentally healthy, and you're okay with it, then that's your choice.
But for you, hold on, Rob. I mean, do you think that for you it was just fear of either rejection from the fans, because we're talking here in a pretty strange culture of metalheads in some ways, or a fear that the band might kick you out?
A little bit of both. Well, actually, no, that's not fair to say the band would kick me out, because they knew I was a gay guy from the moment we got together. However, it's true to say that, yes, I was deeply concerned, because I thought that if I did make that statement, or if I was caught by the paparazzi in a gay bar or whatever, that could have adverse effects on the band and our fans and following, because, as you know, back in the 70s, it was a different time. It was a different experience. Even through to the 80s, you know, there was a tremendous pushback to the LGBTQ community. Mm. And so I was doing everything to protect the band and the great hard work that we were putting in to step up the ladder every so often with our tours and our records. And that is the case, I think, for a lot of people that are struggling with that closet. You're more concerned and fearful of rejection, and you're fearful of creating a fuss and a mess, you know, when you step forward. And, of course, eventually, when I did step forward, I realised, although time had advanced and there was a little bit of a better perception on people like myself, that fearfulness was not really ever called for.
You know, funny thing is, just finally one or two bits, and that's well, that's very well put. I get the impression that while you've had a fantastic 50 years on the road making music and playing to thousands of people every night, etc., that you know, overall loneliness has been right up there at the top through most of your life, hasn't it?
Well, it has. It has to an extent. Yeah, and I didn't realise that. I didn't realise to what extent it had been until, you know, I was doing the audio book, speaking the words out from the page, and then it was starting to hit me, you know. And again, it's just a remarkable, I won't say it's a survival story, although there's a little bit about that, especially with my alcohol and drug abuse, and you know that I came to the end on one occasion, almost came to the end of my life on one occasion. But you know, I have to keep reinforcing this fact of there, but for the grace of God, go I, because as I've grown older and, you know, again, gained more wisdom, I realise that the spiritual path that I've been on has also been there with me since day one. It was something that I wasn't aware of, but I've only since my clean and sober days been able to tune into all that.
Well, Rob, in 1990, you know what I'm going to talk about next, where it all went very strange, so bizarre, so weird, so you couldn't make this stuff up. You were across every single newspaper across the world for all the wrong reasons, and yet it was nothing to do with you, where two kids decided you would put subliminal messages onto an album. It went to a court case, etc. It influenced two teens to attempt suicide. Tragic, tragic ending to the story as well. How did that affect you? And like, was it really difficult?
Yes, we were shocked. We were shocked. We were offended that the suggestion that we would use our music to create that kind of possibility was just too fantastical to even consider. We had no clue that it was going to go as far as the day in Texas when we got off the tour bus and the sheriff gave us a subpoena. And then these lads from the UK had to fly all the way to Reno to fight for our lives in music, you know. But we were determined to have our say. And, of course, in the opening days, it was very apparent that these two beautiful lads that lost their lives were huge fans of Judas Priest, and music was their outlet, you know. But you mix that up with the dysfunctional family and all the other troubling things that they were going through as young men. And it's just like a... It's just like this ball of chaos, and I honestly don't feel even today that they intended to do what they did.
Yeah.
I think that something happened, something triggered, something, whether it was a game or what, it was just a horrible, horrible tragedy. But anyway, there we were, you know, doing what we did and representing ourselves and representing the heavy metal world and so forth. We had a great bunch of people working for us. And the judge, who was completely open to the whole discussion, was very straightforward and took all this information in. And the only sad part for us, I think, Dave, as it still is now, is that the judge left the door a little bit open, you know. He still couldn't quite grasp what this subliminal message thing was. And he still couldn't grasp what this phrasing of the way I was breathing and this idea that this expiration of breath was saying these words, do it, you know. It's just crazy. It's crazy. Do it. Do what? Wash the dishes, mow the lawn. It certainly isn't kill yourself. You know, so it was just a very unfortunate time for us. But we got through it. We got through it. And, you know, the band carried on. But it always is in the back of my mind. Will this ever happen again? Please, God, don't let that be the case.
All right, and just finally, just on that note, just the, what do you call it, the whole idea of, this is a mundane question, but did it affect and change your writing even, saying, OK, wait a minute, I better not write that just in case?
Well, here's the crazy thing. I didn't even write "Do It."
Yeah.
But I certainly take your question that you would think that in thinking this through and going through this grueling 1 month process of having all these wild accusations that you might change your thought process as a lyricist. But I said no. I'm a strong believer in doing whatever you feel is right for your band, for your music, for your art, and expressing it the way that you feel is the honest way of showing yourself. Yeah. And then it's up to you. It's up to the public. Then it's up to your fans to either accept or reject what you do. And so, no, it didn't. It never entered into my mind that I should change that way of writing my words.
And that was Rob Halford, lead singer of Judas Priest, talking to me around the time of the release of his autobiography, Confess. I'll be back with more interviews right after these.
You're listening to the best of Dave Fanning on 2FM.